and answered quietly. She and Lola walked back outside. They leaned against the pedestal of one of the statues. The plaque with the miser's name on it had been shattered beyond legibility, and Anne ran her fingers over the cracks, thinking about the cracks within herself.
"If nothing turns up," Lola said, "I was thinking we could go to Scrap Market. They have old newspapers there, ones Lords probably wrote for."
Anne nodded, trying not to focus on the words, "if nothing turns up." Something would. At some point, the trail needed to lead somewhere.
"That sounds good," she answered.
Lola pulled her harmonica out of her pocket.
"I've always liked puzzles."
Anne almost snapped that her life wasn't a puzzle, wasn't some game. But there was no point in angering the bloodgazer. Anne preferred this Lola to the one who'd wanted her dead. Lola blew out an eerie, low note, appropriate for a garden full of hooded statues. While she played, Anne mentally recited Lord's rules to herself, to release all the pressure in her heart. Those feelings of power and confidence she'd gained from New Reigns felt like a dream in this moment, caught between another dead end and another lead. She rubbed her lipstick off on the back of her hand. Maybe it didn't suit her after all. Levi. It was the end of Levi's Saturday night shift. He was dressed in an emerald St. Maur's suit, complete with silver cufflinks and sapphire velvet tie. The moment he left the Trop's room to begin his break, he slipped the jacket off and draped it over his shoulder. He hated to wear Vianca's clothes any longer than he had to, and it felt especially wrong to be in his uniform, pretending everything else was fine. He rolled the sleeves of his shirt up his forearms, exposing the matching ace and spade tattoos. Vianca's woman had brought makeup to cover the impressive shiner on his left eye, but the tone was too pale, and it left him looking even more sickly than he felt. He should consider himself lucky to be walking, limping, really, only several hours after waking up. One broken rib, the doctor had said. A concussion. A minor stab wound that would leave him with a permanent scar. And a lethal blow to his pride. He still had his tattoos, but without the irons, he didn't know who he was anymore. He was Levi Glazier, but that was the name his father had given him. The Iron Lord was the one he'd fashioned for himself. He was surprised Chez hadn't come back to finish the job. Typically, an oath broke when someone died during the duel, or if the Lord relinquished their claim on their vassal. If Jack hadn't fought off Chez, Levi would be at the bottom of the brint right now. But he wasn't dead, so the oath was still, at least partially, intact. Regardless, Chez was probably marching around Old Town, calling himself the new Iron Lord. The thought of it made Levi feel worse than all the injuries combined. He had been humiliated, betrayed, and beaten. Dying might have been a more merciful fate. To make matters worse, Chez had stolen the 500 volts he'd already been planning to give to the Irons. Ungrateful bastard. Levi hadn't seen N since last night, and he had no idea if she knew what had happened, or if she had ever hunted down that bank. The thought of her seeing him like this was more than a little embarrassing, but she would soon find out one way or another. And besides, he wanted to catch the last half of her show. Not needing to pay for tickets while wearing his St. Maur's uniform, Levi strolled into the theatre. It was dark. Intermission must have just ended. He stood in the back, rather than squeeze into an empty seat in the middle of a row. A dozen burlesque dancers on stage performed some kind of interpretive theatre, pointing and running as a group of acrobatic birds swooped down and clawed at their heads. He spotted N immediately. She was dressed in black, with droopy wings that spread apart as she swung. It was obvious from only a few minutes of performing that she was one of the more talented acrobats on the stage, despite her minor role in the show. The Dondelaires were from the highest tier of acrobatic families, just as the Glaziers were the most respected of orb makers. The orchestra hit a crescendo. Crack! The sky broke open, and glitter rained over the performers. Lights flashed, one of the male dancers brandished a golden sword and pointed it toward the birds. But as soon as he gained his balance, one of the birds on the lowest trapeze kicked the sword from his hands. It clattered across the stage and stopped beside one of the smaller dancers. The young man grabbed it, and the moment he did, the glitter stopped falling and light poured in from above. There was a final dance number, but the acrobats were gone. Seemed like a pretty useless story to Levi, but he didn't know much about art. The bows began, and the acrobats took the stage as a group. En smiled and curtsied with the rest of them, and Levi couldn't take his eyes off her. Very briefly, En's gaze found his, even from all the way on the stage. She smiled wider. Levi decided the whole show had been worth it just for that. He left soon after, and a crowd of women in flowing satin gowns and men drowned in cologne exited behind him. Levi eyed a vase of orchids on the concierge's counter. People gave performers flowers, right? But he decided against it. He already had a stolen box of cookies wedged awkwardly in his pocket, and turned down one of the small hallways that led backstage. It was empty. When he reached a door labeled dressing room, Levi stopped and leaned against the wall. En was probably changing. He didn't mind waiting a few minutes. A little while later, another performer popped out and startled at seeing Levi there, looking as ill as he did. Her eyes ran over his St. Morse uniform with suspicion. Levi might have been well known in the casino, but he wasn't so recognizable outside of the Trops room, especially by those who didn't pay attention to the city's most notable dealers. He self-consciously adjusted his tie and wiped at the concealer on his eye. Maybe coming to see En was a bad idea, but it seemed silly to turn back now. Levi cleared his throat.
"I'm looking for En."
The girl nodded and disappeared. En stepped out a moment later, still in her costume, but without her wings or feathered skirt. Heavy black stage lashes covered her eyes, and her cheeks were extra pink. Despite the fact that she looked a bit ridiculous, Levi couldn't help but stare at the way the lacy leotard hugged her waist, and the makeup accentuated the pout of her cupid's bow.
"You look nice," he managed.
She looked at him closely and gasped. "What happened to you? Are you all right?" She lifted a hand toward his face, rubbed the skin under his eye, and inspected the purple bruise with concern. Under different circumstances, Levi would have been happy to submit to her touch. But he could already see the unease in her eyes. He swatted her hand away and smiled, a bit too widely.
"I'm fine."
"You look terrible."
"Really? I feel great."
She crossed her arms. "Are you really not going to tell me what happened?"
I had a bit of an argument with Chez."
"Looks like he won." He winced.
"Take it easy on me."
"But Chez is your third." She bit her lip. "I thought oaths prevented things like this." Levi took a deep, shameful breath.
"It's called a challenge, when someone tries to overthrow the Lord. It's normally a duel to the death, and it would have been if Jack hadn't shown up."
She made a face like she was the one who was ill. Exactly the sort of pity Levi didn't need.
"Never mind that," he said quickly. "Did you visit the bank today?"
She gave him a pointed look, like she knew he was stalling. "Yes. There was barely anything in the vault. We found a strange black orb, and an even stranger miser token. I don't know what to think of either of them." Levi had never heard of a black orb before.
"Can I take a look at the orb?"
"Yes, I'll bring it tomorrow," she answered. "There was an address listed on the account, some place called the Street of the Holy Tombs. Lola said it was in Old Town." Levi crinkled his nose.
"I know that place. Mysterious black orbs and old coins. That's exactly the neighborhood you're looking for. It's full of the faithful. It gives me the creeps just to walk through it."
"Well, I'm going tomorrow to call on a woman named Zula Slick." The name sounded vaguely familiar to Levi, but he couldn't remember why. En hesitated for a moment before continuing. "It would be great if you could come with me. But do you think you'll feel up for it?"
"Of course I will."
He cracked his neck.
takes more than a broken rib and a cut to slow me down.
Truthfully, entering Iron Land was a dangerous notion right now, but Old Town was his territory, his claim. He refused to let himself fear it. Besides, he'd brave worse than that for N. All she had to do was ask. Lola also suggested trying Scrap Market, if this doesn't pan out. Her face was doing that expressionless thing. She was upset. What he should have done was console her. Of course something would turn up. Problem was that something would probably be Lord's corpse. Levi was already struggling to pick up the pieces of his own shattered life. He couldn't bear to watch N go through that too. Instead, he said,
"Scrap Market is a bad idea. It's dangerous now that Scavenger is Scar-Lord. I wouldn't risk it myself, even if I didn't get the muck kicked out of me today. And you shouldn't go either."
"I wasn't asking for your permission," she snapped. His instincts were correct. She was definitely upset. He stepped closer and placed a hand on her shoulder.
"I know that. I just think it's better if you stay away from there."
His voice sounded more forceful than he meant it to. She pushed his hand off her. "I know you've had a bad day, Levi, but don't do this. I don't need to be patronized." He sighed.
"I know that. I'm just
trying to protect you." He pulled the box of cookies out of his pocket.
"I brought you these. Truce?"
The corner of her lips tilted into a smile. "Thanks," she said, tearing into the box, easily appeased. He shifted the weight off his bad leg and closed his eyes. Even so, he could still feel the pity of N's stare.
"Stop looking at me like that," he said.
"Like what?"
"Like you're sorry for me."
He shook his head.
"I deserved what I got."
He meant it, too. It was a hollow feeling, less like guilt and more like dejection. He was a pawn playing at being king. If he'd ever been anything more, if he was ever meant to be anything more, he wouldn't have fallen so low. Saint or crook, it didn't matter. If New Reigns was a game, then he'd already lost. "What do you mean?" she asked. Under different circumstances, maybe he would have told her the truth. He wanted to. Someone stronger than himself needed to hold him accountable for what he'd done to the Irons. It would be easy. All he needed to do was pull the two shadow cards out of his pocket.
"I never pretended to be a good man," he'd say. "But I never wanted to be this."
But he didn't tell her. Not because of the shame, but because he knew that he was a trouble she didn't need. N's Omerta was just another example of how Levi had failed the people who depended on him. The difference between her and him was that she'd given up everything to save someone, and Levi had given up everyone to save himself. N didn't deserve her own problems. She certainly didn't deserve Levi's too. Maybe he'd tell her after all of this was over. Iron Lord or not, he would find a way to pay Cedric back. He'd lost nearly everything to the city's game, but he wouldn't lose his life. Only 5 days from now, when the worst was behind him, he'd tell her about all the wrongs he'd committed and all the people he'd cheated. He would tell her how sorry he was for the role he'd played with her and Bianca, and he would tell her that, even after losing everything he'd ever wanted, he still desperately wanted her.
"I didn't mean anything," he said.
But when he met her eyes, he could tell that she didn't believe him. He fought back the urge to touch her again, on her shoulder, her hand, her waist. Even if he stepped closer, it wouldn't feel close enough. N was becoming more to him than just an attraction. She was the girl who'd come afraid to the city that could smell your fear. She'd faced the witch, she'd poisoned the wolf. She'd strolled into the land of death with her head held high and left it a lord. She was an impossible player in a fixed game, the only person not playing to win. Maybe Levi had spent too many nights dreaming of the legends of these streets, fantasizing about the day he'd get to finally show his hand. Even after he'd lost, N was a fascination, a temptation, and a delirious hope that the game wasn't over, but only just beginning. She grabbed his left hand, not to hold it, but to turn it over. She traced her finger over the spade tattoo on his arm with a thoughtful expression on her face. She looked at it as if it were a scar. "You look more lost than I do," N said, her voice hinting at both laughter and sadness. In that moment, he didn't feel lost, but he would as soon as she let go. Suddenly, the air smelled like warm, dark blue, and tasted of bourbon with a trace of espresso. It moved in swirls, like the caress of the wind picking up before a storm. Surprised, he let out a faint moan from the back of his throat. She smelled like a gambler's ruin. It had been over 4 years since he'd sensed a new aura, and it came upon him so unexpectedly that he almost staggered. It was so different from the others he'd known before. The quiet whisper of Jack's grey, the avarice laced in Bianca's green, the volatile flames of his father's red. N's aura made him dizzy, like he'd stared too long at the spaces between the stars, or dived too deep from shallows into ocean. It felt tangible enough to lace between his fingers, though it looked like curls of smoke. In the dim lighting of the hallway, it danced eerily across the carpet, the billowing train of a sapphire gown, the twisting of beasts and passions in her shadow. 6 days was an extraordinarily short time for him to start sensing an aura. And as she held his arm, her gaze locked on his, her lips poised between boldness and uncertainty, the more 5 days from now seemed an excruciatingly long time to wait. Just as his desire was about to overwhelm his sense of logic, N let go of him and took several steps back. Her reaction shouldn't have surprised him. They'd reached this moment before, and time after time, she'd made it clear what she did and didn't want. "I should go," she said suddenly. "Back to the troop, I mean. They'll wonder where I am."
"You're right outside the dressing room," he thought. But Levi knew excuses, and rejection when he had it.
The last thing he should be focusing on right now was romance, but still, her words stung.
"The Street of the Holy Tombs," he said, dragging their conversation and their relationship back to business. 10, tomorrow morning. You won't be missing me this time."
Day 7. In the City of Sin, secrets are their own sort of currency, and reputation holds more power than fortune. The City of Sin, a guidebook. Where to go and where not to. N. Old Town reminded N of a graveyard or a mausoleum, with the way its atmosphere evoked the decaying and forgotten, embraced monsters and nightmares. The Street of the Holy Tombs was in the center of Old Town, and one of the few neighborhoods with active residents. It was the cathedral to the graveyard, the beating heart of a mostly dead corpse. Ghostly wind chimes dangled in every window, weather-worn gargoyles perched on the buttresses overhead, their faces contorted with hunger and wrath. Creeds were painted on every door, and candles burned on broken windowsills. "It's very charming," N managed. With every step, she braced herself in case a wandering spectre or beast jumped out at her. The Street of the Holy Tombs had a way of undermining her sense of reality. She fought the urge to stand closer to Levi, remembering how last night she'd so nearly accepted his advances and surrendered herself to new reins. Every touch, every look from Levi was a temptation to abandon the girl she'd always been. N might have strayed from a few of her ladylike ideals, but she wouldn't lose her entire identity. When she did leave this city, she would leave it in one piece.
"Believe it or not," Levi said, "people come to this street looking for a scare. There are museums of medical abnormalities, catacombs lined with skulls, nightclubs of mirror mazes and horrors."
"It doesn't look like it's all for show," she said. Creeds and any practice of the faith were forbidden, and N didn't think even the greediest citizens of New Reigns would display them just for the sake of profit.
It's not.
They found the storefront for number 19, a place called Her Forgotten Histories. A middle-aged woman with short curly hair sat outside on a rocking chair, her face hidden behind today's copy of The Crimes and the Times, whose front-page headline announced the 2-year anniversary of the disappearance of Chancellor Malcolm Semper's daughter. The woman wore a wooden creed around her neck, nearly twice as large as Jack's. "Do you think that's her?" N whispered. "Zula Slick?"
"I'm not sure," he said.
A white cat purred and rubbed at the hem of N's skirt. White cats supposedly brought bad luck, a thought N might not have considered if they were anywhere but a street devoted to superstition.
"Can I help you?" the woman called to them.
"We're looking for someone named Zula Slick," N said.
She folded down a newspaper.
"That would be me."
"Don't get your hopes up," N reminded herself. There was an aching wound inside her from missing lords, and these words wrapped it in a protective shell. If she kept her expectations low, she wouldn't feel the throbbing. If she cut off all her emotions, she wouldn't be so weak. Zula inspected them as they walked closer.
"I've always wanted to meet Vyanka's other boy," she said.
At first, Anne thought she was referring to Vyanka's son, which was absurd. Levi and Vyanka had plainly different heritages.
"Ah," Zula said, her gaze falling on N. "She never told me she had a girl."
Then N realized what Zula meant. The Omerta. But how could she know? She spoke as if Vyanka's shackles dangled visibly from their wrists. Zula's amicable expression fell as N drew closer. She squinted at N's features, as though she recognized her from somewhere. Or perhaps N reminded her a person she would rather not see.
"Does Vyanka know who you are?"
Zula asked, her voice suddenly full of bite. En stopped, her heart racing. If Zula knew who she really was, then surely she wouldn't be another dead-end lead.
"Do you?"
En asked, nervously, hopefully. Zula shakily drew her hand to her chest and stood up from her chair.
"Come inside. I know why you're here."
N and Levi exchanged a cautious glance.
"What if this is a trick?" Levi whispered.
There were only 3 names on that bank account. Mine, Lord's, and hers. Lord's must have trusted her. She felt a pang in her chest. If Zula knew N's true identity, then Lord's had trusted Zula more than she'd trusted her own daughter. Levi nodded, and they followed Zula inside. A black printing press took up the majority of the room. Among the remaining space, desks were wedged against bookcases, papers dried on clotheslines tied to lamps, and the backs of chairs. A framed painting of a martyr hung on the back wall. Her Forgotten Histories was a newspaper. That made sense, since Lords was a journalist. Perhaps that was how they'd met. Zula drew the blinds closed over each of the windows, even shooed the cat outside. She motioned for both of them to sit at a desk.
"I should have known you'd come," Zula said. "I always told Lords to give you my name. Who else would keep you safe? But I didn't think she'd listen, so obstinate. Never grew out of that."
N drew in a shaky breath. That was definitely Lords.
"How do you know her?"
"I'm her oldest and only friend."
There was an unmistakable sadness in Zula's voice that N tried to ignore.
"Well, you weren't wrong about her not listening," N admitted.
"Lord sent me to Levi, not to you."
Zula barked out a laugh.
"Vyanka's orb maker? Ridiculous. As if she'd send you anywhere near a woman as powerful and terrible as Vyanka Augustine."
"But you know Vyanka too, don't you?" Levi said. "That's how you know about her talent, and us."
"Vyanka and I share some political connections," Zula said carefully. "But no, that's not how I know."
She closed her eyes, and a set of tattoos darkened on her eyelids. They too looked like eyes, though lacking pupils or any color.
I can see shades. That is my talent. Curses, secrets, regrets, passions, sacrifices, desires. I see them like shadows that cling to everyone.
That's nonsense, Levi said,
and En shot him a look. He was being rude, and they needed this woman's help.
You see auras, don't you? It's not so different.
She turned toward En, her eyes still closed. Goosebumps shot up En's arms.
Tell me, what do you see when you look at her?
Levi cleared his throat and adjusted his shirt collar. He looked over En's shoulder. En mimicked his movement, but there was nothing behind her. She felt strangely on display. She'd never known Levi could read auras, had never sought to ask about his split talent. Levi's gaze fell to the floor, an embarrassed expression on his face. En resisted the urge to fix her hair or adjust her clothes. What exactly could he see?
Perhaps you can't see it, then, Zula said. It's a curse. Both of you share it.
The street of the Holy Tombs might have been a frightening place, but this was pushing the limits of En's logic.
That isn't why we're here.
I can see it, Zula said quietly. The hallway.
En instantly thought of the hallway from her dreams, the place of memories and fantasies, with the black and white doors. Both En and Levi quickly met each other's eyes. They'd obviously both been struck by Zula's words.
That's just a nightmare, Levi said hoarsely.
En was startled, both by Levi's admission and the distress in his voice. Had he seen the hallway too? But how was that possible? She'd seen it only in her dreams.
It's a shade that binds you both, Zula said.
Feeling a bit shaky, and her patience quickly wearing thin, En pulled the first item from the bank out of her purse. The king token.
I came to New Reims looking for lords, En said, placing it on Zula's desk. I need to know where she is.
Zula looked at the token like it was venomous.
You shouldn't have removed it. It was safe in the bank.
En pursed her lips. She didn't deserve Zula's anger.
It's hot to the touch. Do you know what it is?
It's tragedy, Zula snapped. Countless people die because of what it is. I won't divulge its secret.
Zula's vagueness was grating on En's nerves. She'd traveled 1,000 miles and overcome horrendous obstacles to find answers, and now this woman would withhold them from her.
Please,
she said, but her aggravation was obvious through her mask of politeness.
I need to know.
Then you'll be disappointed. You should return it.
En slid it back into her purse, though she had no intention of returning it at all. She retrieved the second item and placed it in front of the woman.
What about the orb?
Zula took a shuddering breath.
I know what it is. Where did you get it?
It was in the bank, En said.
She frowned.
That doesn't make sense. Lords wouldn't own anything like that.
Levi picked it up and inspected it.
These aren't vaults, he said, which En already knew. But...
he shivered.
I can sometimes feel traces of miser auras left on vaults. But this isn't a trace. It feels... alive.
Have you ever heard of the shadow game? Zula asked them.
En's and Levi's head shot up, and a sickly dread caught in En's throat.
So you have. The Phoenix Club hasn't opened the House of Shadow since the Great Street War. At least not until 8 days ago.
She opened a drawer from behind her desk and pulled out a second black orb, identical to the other, except empty inside.
The Shadow Game is the game of death,
and the players bet their lives. These orbs hold life energy. They are deadly poker chips.
Levi hurriedly set the orb back on the table.
Whose life is inside this one, then?
That's a very good question. Only one player in history has ever survived the Shadow Game, but now that she's dead, there shouldn't be any life left inside it.
Zula's eyes narrowed as she inspected N, her gaze fixed more over her shoulder than on N's face.
I don't know the details of that night, but it's possible Gabrielle didn't play with her own life. She wasn't alone in the game.
You mean Gabrielle Dondelaire? N guessed. My birth mother.
Lord said she'd never tell you that, Zula said sharply.
N's breath hitched. There was no question now. What they'd learned about Gabrielle was absolutely true.
I saw a bloodgazer. I did my research.
You saw a bloodgazer?
Zula gaped.
You know your father's blood name?
Do you know who he was? N asked. Zula slammed the desk drawer closed, making both N and Levi jolt.
I cannot speak his names.
But I should know. I deserve to know.
I'd tell you if I could. His identity is protected, and he went to great lengths to see it so.
That meant his secret was sealed by a protector, someone like Lord's. N felt like she was grasping at smoke, trying to connect glimpses of the past together. N cleared her throat. But he is dead, right? Zula took a shaky breath.
Yes, he's gone.
N knew this. Of course she did. But it still hurt to hear it after hoping over and over again.
When you said that Gabrielle wasn't alone in the game, Levi said, what did you mean?
There was only one other person involved that night. Since these orbs are used for nothing beyond the game, and since it cannot belong to Gabrielle, then that only leaves her daughter.
Zula met N's eyes solemnly.
Gabrielle must have been playing for your life that night.
N swallowed and stared at the orb. That was her own life inside it?
The reason I bring up the game, Zula said gravely, is because of why you're here. Lords had been running from the game for some time, but 8 days ago, they found her. And she was invited to play.
The shell N had carefully built around her heart, shattered. And no number of words or rules would piece it back together now. Before Zula even confirmed N's darkest fears, tears began to well in N's eyes.
Mock, Levi whispered. Of all the stories from the Great Street War, Lord's was the most heartbreaking of them all, Zula said, shaking her head grimly. Until the end, she did everything in her power to protect you. And now, here you are, a curse in your shadow, and a myrtle around your neck.
The past tense struck N deep and low, like a bell toll that shook inside of her. She would have known. She would have felt it if Lords had died. She placed a hand over her mouth. Her chest heaved, though she hadn't started to cry yet. She hadn't even taken a breath.
With the Omerta, you can't go home, Zula continued. You must keep your secret from Bianca at all costs. And, more than anything, stay away from the House of Shadows. Lords did not die, so you would too. Enough, Levi snapped.
He reached for N's hand, but N's gaze was firmly rooted on the floor.
The only fortune in any of this, Zula continued, is that you have no power yet. That's better for you, and better for New Reigns. Enough, Levi hollered.
He stood abruptly, grabbing N by the shoulder and hoisting her up as well. N leaned into the support of his arm around her, holding her breath so as not to cry. She should say something she knew.
Levi shouldn't fight this battle for her. But it felt pointless, knowing she'd already lost the war.
If you were really Lord's friend, you could try showing an ounce of compassion.
Zula's expression hardened.
This story will end badly.
The same words Lola had spoken the other day. This story is already over, En thought. I'm trapped here, and I'm alone. Levi pulled En toward the door, and she numbly followed.
I don't expect we'll be back, he spat.
He was right. En had no intention of ever seeing this awful woman again, even if she had been Lord's friend.
I'm the only one left who remembers, Zula said solemnly. If I need to find you, I will. Don't.
Levi slammed the door. Outside, he shushed En, even though she wasn't crying, and pressed her against his chest.
I'm sorry, he said.
The words were gentle, but uselessly so. En was already broken.
I'm so sorry.
Lords had died the day before En reached New Reigns. All this time she'd been searching for her face in the crowds, wandering memories of her in her dreams, and she'd been chasing a ghost. Had she left earlier? Had she asked questions earlier? It was always the two of us and no one else, En whispered. And now I'm alone. Without Lords, En was truly lost. Her mother was the only one who'd remember the girl En had been before, now that En was already starting to forget herself. Lords was her lighthouse, her guideline, and now En had no way of finding her way back, to Bellamy, to herself, or to the life she'd once lived. Her mother had probably died thinking that, at the very least, her daughter was safe at home, and that was the tragedy of it all.
You're not alone, Levi murmured, squeezing her tighter.
En looked up at him, studying her own heartbreak reflected in his eyes. Finally, she began to cry. Compared to her mother, Levi was a pale sliver of light, a fraying thread. But he was something. And so she nodded, and let him guide her home.
Day 8. Legends of the North Side are born in the gutters and die on the gallows. The City of Sin, a guidebook. Where to go and where not to. N. N curled into a fetal position and leaned against the pole on a corner of the trapeze platform. The dusty windows of the practice warehouse gleamed with moonlight and the flashing advertisements of Trop Street. She'd been here all night, ever since the show ended hours before. It was the second performance Lords had ever missed. Her mother used to claim she had the best view in the back, and last night, after her second show, En had checked the back row dozens of times, both out of habit and longing, staring into the faces of strangers. Before En had left Bellamy, she'd already had a list of questions to ask Lords. Since arriving in New Reigns, she felt like the city had handed her two new mysteries for every question answered. If En had only one more chance to speak to Lords, only one question to ask, it wouldn't be about her parents, about the bank, or even about the lies. Tell me your story, she'd plead. The heartbreak that Zula had mentioned, the memory of Lords crying while holding baby En. She needed to know. How had Lords known her parents? What happened during the Great Street War? How young had she been? Had she asked for this? White chalk coated En's hands, and she drew zigzags with it on her thighs. Her fingernails left scratch marks on her pale skin. Alongside her grief, a darker thought lingered. One En had suspected, but Zula had confirmed. En had spent her life on the periphery of her world, no matter how hard she worked, no matter how desperately she tried, until she arrived in the City of Sin. 9 days ago, Zula had said. Lords had died the day before En arrived in New Reigns. The day before En arrived in New Reigns, Lords' protection had broken. N had already known Lords had used her talents to keep N safe, but she hadn't truly understood what that meant. Her mother had kept her invisible. Now N's memories of Lords wiping away her daughter's frustrated tears, of teasing her about her social ambitions, they all seemed tainted. N had never suffered in her life, not truly, but that didn't mean those hurts hadn't mattered to her. She'd agonized over them, she'd accepted them, and Lords had watched. Hot, bitter tears sprang from N's eyes. She'd cried a lot since yesterday. She'd cried for the story of her mother's life that she'd never know, for a woman she somehow both loved and resented. She'd cried for the girl she used to be. From her first lie to Levi, her poisoning of Cedric, her battle with Lola, the city was turning her into someone she didn't recognize. But the more she thought about her life before, about her ambitions and her character, N knew she'd always been this determined, this ruthless. Thanks to Lord's protection, she'd merely lacked the opportunity to truly know herself. She was a pistol wrapped up in silk. She was a blade disguised as a girl. N practiced for another hour on the trapeze, pushing her limits with tricks and moves she wasn't ready for. Repeatedly, she lost her grip on the bar, or her strength gave out. She'd begun to relish how it felt to fall. While climbing the ladder to the platform, N suddenly noticed that she had a real audience. Lola watched from far below, her arms crossed. N vaguely remembered something about scrap market, a promise she'd made before.
"How long have you been here?" N called.
"Not long," she answered.
"I couldn't find you in the casino. Didn't think you wanted to cancel our trip, though."
N had no reason to go to scrap market now. Digging up Lord's old newspaper articles wouldn't change anything, wouldn't bring her back. But telling Lola about Lord's would acknowledge what had happened, and that seemed more difficult than pretending everything was normal.
"Are the Iron Boys coming?" Lola asked.
She hadn't seen Levi since yesterday evening. He'd been nothing but kind to her, but still, she preferred to be alone with her grief. If he came, she wouldn't be able to keep up her charade.
"No," she said. "It's just us."
It was so early that the sun had yet to rise. Dew and fog clung to the streets in front of the abandoned factory in Scarland, the noise inside piercing through the night's quiet. Since her first encounter with Lola, N hadn't ventured outside of St. Morse after dark, so she'd grown accustomed to the ever-present loudness of Trop Street, where dice rattled and drunkards sang no matter the hour. Here in the factory district, the silence felt almost tangible, heavy and cold. Lola pushed open the factory's doors, and the two of them slipped inside. It was almost as large as a city block, with various stalls and carts clustered in the rows between machinery and conveyor belts. The bustle of the crowd reverberated around the interior, a chorus of haggling and bidding for everything from food to weapons. It smelled of cigarettes and roasted sausage, neither of which appealed to N's unsettled stomach. 100 feet or more above their heads, children climbed the rafters and vents as if they were a playground.
"They could fall," N said.
She twisted the inside of her dress's pockets in her fist. The crowds made her claustrophobic, though she'd never felt that way before. Maybe she simply wasn't used to scrap market. Maybe what she called anxiety, others called thrill. But a sense of dread embedded itself in her stomach, and every click of her heels sounded like the loading of a gun. She shouldn't have agreed to come.
"Nah, they won't fall," Lola answered. "They're just showing off, trying to get noticed by the guild."
Ben normally would have asked what she meant, but she was too exhausted. Part of her decided that she no longer cared, that this city would always be a mystery no matter how much she attempted to understand it.
"Let's stop over here first," Lola said, pointing to a stall covered with huge pieces of fabric and moth-eaten tapestries. "Asking what we're asking, we might want a bit of anonymity."
She ruffled through the bins of used clothing and fished out a thin black sash.
"Here, it almost matches that lipstick you have."
N rubbed the satin between her fingers. The quality was reasonable, and unlike the rest of the clothes, there weren't any stains or rips. Lola cut two even holes in the satin with her scalpel knife, then tied it behind N's head.
"Feel good?"
Lola asked. "Sure," N said flatly. After they paid for the sash, Lola slipped a mask of her own out of her pocket, tied it on, and led N to another stall. The air around it was so humid from the steam vent nearby that N felt like she was breathing sludge. Inside, a man with yellow lips sat on a stool holding a pipe. He wore a glove on one hand, but pieces of hay stuck out of it. In fact, his entire left sleeve was lumpy and thicker than the right.
"He's got old newspapers he's willing to sell," Lola whispered.
"Hello," the man greeted them. "Who are you two who look up to no good?"
"My name is..." N started until Lola elbowed her side. N reddened, chagrined. Masks were useless if they gave away their names.
"We're customers."
"Pleasure to meet you."
"We're looking for old newspapers," Lola said. "Articles by specific journalists."
"How old are we talking?"
He set his pipe on the table.
10 to 20 years ago.
"What journalists are you looking for?"
Lola nodded for N to speak, and N took a deep breath until she found her voice.
"We're interested in a writer named Seance."
That was the pen name Raymond had told her the day she'd arrived. He sucked on his bottom lip. Its yellow color made him look almost inhuman.
"Ah, you are up to no good. I used to read the pseudonyms when I was young and foolish."
He leaned forward. His straw arm remained in the same spot, so with his position it made his shoulder look detached.
"There was Jester, another pen name, Ventriloquist, Nostalgia, Shade."
"Do you have any of the papers?" N asked. She hadn't realized until now how much she wanted to read one of Lord's articles. Even knowing they had reached their ultimate dead end, and there was no chance they would find her mother alive, she could still learn more about why Lords had led her double life. And she could hear the words from Lords herself. It was the closest she would ever get to her mother's story.
"I might have one that escaped the burnings," he said.
"You might?"
"It will cost you 15 volts. Or a trade."
15 volts was hardly pocket change, but it was worth it. Bianca's first paycheck had already arrived, both for N's acrobatics performances and her other assignment. It was very generous. N would not hurt for volts in this city if she continued to work at St. Morse.
"I'll pay in volts," she said.
He eyed her skeptically.
"Fine."
His straw arm hung limply as he walked to one of the tables and reached for a box underneath. He riffled through piles of old newspapers and pamphlets.
"How'd you lose your arm?"
Lola asked. The man smiled. His teeth were even yellower than his lips.
"I sold it."
N's stomach did an unpleasant somersault. He grabbed a thin newspaper and a small, cheap-looking orb, grey-tinted glass, with a murky look to it, from a soup can on the table. N wondered if it could even hold the 15 volts, but she pulled one of her own orbs from her pocket anyway, unscrewed the cap and paid. His shoddy orb managed the transaction without shattering. He handed her the paper. It was called The Antiquist. This issue must have featured one of Lord's articles. N folded it and slipped it in her breast pocket.
"That's the only one I got," he said.
"Thank you,"
N told him, and she meant it. She crossed her arms protectively to keep the paper close to her chest.
"What's your name? We haven't met many who know about the pseudonyms."
"Sold my name, too."
"Why? Thanks for your help,"
Lola said suddenly. She pushed N out of the stall before she could finish her question. Upon re-entering the market, however, someone sprinting down the aisle slammed into N's side. She yelped and nearly toppled over Lola's boots. The girl who'd hit her had scars covering her palms. She ran out of sight, swallowed by the crowds. In the stall across from them, a man cleared away his food cart. A pile of cabbages dropped and rolled on the floor, and a woman tripped on one as she hurried past. Everywhere people packed, people ran.
A gun fired on the other side of the factory, and N's heart jolted so fast she almost retched.
White boots! It's a raid on the Scarhands, Lola said, anxiously reaching for N's arm. We need to get out of here.
Hordes of people rushed toward the exit of the factory, trampling each other and clogging the only escape route. N and Lola followed, but it was soon clear that the crowd wasn't moving. Even on her tiptoes, N couldn't see ahead.
What's happening? The door must be closed.
Behind them, White Boots charged into the crowd, their guns and batons raised. They looked like wolves herding sheep to slaughter. The man turned and smacked N's side with his bag. She staggered as the heavy bundle knocked the wind out of her, and her heart slammed into her throat. Beside her, another person cursed when N knocked whatever they were carrying out of their hands. They were packed in here, trapped. N fearfully reached for the revolver in her pocket, but Lola grabbed her wrist and shook her head.
Don't bother, she said, her eyes downcast. That first night, when I took your gun, I unloaded it. I never gave the bullets back.
N's eyes widened. She glanced down and opened the revolver's compartment, and sure enough, it was empty. She resisted the urge to snap at Lola. Of all the times to be out of bullets. N might have been able to escape any real punishment from the White Boots, though any encounter with them was a risk of exposure. But Lola had the doves white in her hair. It didn't matter what she had or hadn't done. She'd be marked as guilty. If anyone was feeling the pain of their lack of ammo, it was Lola.
We need to find a way out, Lola squeaked.
N searched for another exit or a place to hide, but with the crowd she could see nowhere but up. Above their heads, the kids on the rafters climbed toward a window. A boy pulled himself through it onto the roof, to safety. Her eyes fell on a huge piece of machinery, some sort of retired generator. Not far from that was a column with two bars that branched out like a Y.
Come on, N said.
Their hands still clasped, she pulled Lola through the crowd and toward the generator. Stepping on a lever, N climbed onto the huge mechanical cylinder and hoisted herself up.
You're shot,
Lola breathed once she realized N's plan. She stared at the kids near the ceiling with wide eyes. But then she reached up and grasped N's hand, and N pulled her up. After a few moments of hesitation, Lola jumped the column. She landed awkwardly on one foot, but managed to steady herself. N leaped and landed behind her. Lola scrambled up with her arms wrapped around the pole so tightly that her shirt bunched around her neck, exposing part of her stomach.
You need to climb faster, N urged. Before they notice us.
The White Boots had reached the crowd. One of them grabbed a girl by her hair and pulled her down to her knees. Others pointed their clubs at the wide-eyed customers, who raised their arms in surrender. In the front, a group of men pounded against the closed door and screamed. N swung herself around the angled pole, her back facing down, and climbed the opposite column with her legs wrapped around the beam. Now she wouldn't need to wait for Lola to move faster. The bolts on the side of the column were large enough to grasp. N made it to one of the metal rafters near the ceiling. It wasn't until she'd seized it and swung her legs over that she looked down. The climb hadn't appeared quite so high from the ground. Lola, on the other hand, seemed all too aware of this. She climbed to the steady rhythm of muck, muck, muck. At least a dozen children huddled on the rafters, some as young as 7. They watched N in fascination and nervousness as she stood. She probably looked rather intimidating in her black mask. Below, a few people pointed at her, saw her. N was reminded once again that she was no longer invisible. She was powerful, but she was also vulnerable. Lola appeared several feet away, dripping sweat. She hauled herself up with all the gracefulness of a walrus.
Shots! Your shots!
N ignored her and calculated the route to the window that she'd seen the boy escape from earlier. Then she realized why the other children hadn't moved. There was a 12-foot gap between their beam and the one near the window. A huge black cord spanned across the distance, pulled taut. Several kids on either side worked to knot it to the closest beams. A tightrope. Lola blanched.
There's no mucking way!
How did they already get over there? N asked the kids. They came in from there, from the roof,
answered a girl with waist-length black hair. She looked to be about 11.
We took the stairs.
She nodded to the opposite end of the factory, where a stairwell climbed most of the way up a corner wall to reach an office level. N hadn't seen it, being so far away, with all the white boots between here and there. She and Lola had taken a more strenuous route. No wonder the kids had looked at them with such amazement.
We should just wait, Lola said, her voice shaking. The white boots will leave eventually.
Or come up eventually, the girl muttered.
N looked down again. Several of the white boots already stood still, watching them, waiting them out.
The white boots will be gentle with you, N told the girl. You're all young. What could they...
The girl shook her head and showed N her hands. They were covered in scars. N realized all of them bore matching marks. They were children.
We just swore, the girl explained. Eight Fingers never let us, but Scavenger did.
Which meant all of them, not just Lola, were in danger. N inched over to the cord. No net to catch her here.
You could just wrap your legs around the cord and hang upside down, N said, as Lola crawled on her stomach closer to her,
her chin pressed against the cruel metal of the rafter. She looked absurd, all trembling and pale. Then N realized that maybe it was she who looked absurd, confident enough to stand and give direction.
There are holes in the wire, Lola said,
indicating several bare patches with no covering. At the cord's other end, it was plugged into a machine on the ceiling.
That might be on. Touch it and you're fried.
Rubber soles, Anne reminded her. She flicked the cord in a safe spot. It wasn't perfectly taut, but the give wasn't severe.
Fall and you die, Lola countered. Then use your clothes.
The black-haired girl slid off her jacket. She carefully walked around N, then slipped her coat over the cord and wrapped both sleeves around her wrists and clenched hands.
You're actually doing that, hissed the boy beside her.
He had swollen cheeks, like he'd recently had a tooth pulled. She shot him a devious smirk.
Yeah, tell them all to watch.
She fell. The jacket turned over the cord, holding her, and she wrapped her legs around the wire. The other children watched in awe as she crawled upside down to the other side. They were moving, and that was a start.
You go next,
the girl called across to the boy. Crying unabashedly, he slipped his knitted scarf over the cord and bound it to his wrists. He slowly eased his way off the beam and wrapped his ankles around the top of the wire. It took him ages to move even an inch.
Kelvin, you gotta move faster,
the girl urged impatiently from the other side.
There are others waiting.
However, only a few of the others looked willing to even attempt the cross.
I'm...
Kelvin stammered. He was a third of the way across now and shaking uncontrollably.
He looks like he's gonna piss himself,
another girl behind N, around 9 years old, said loudly enough for Kelvin to hear. N was torn between shock at her language and fear that Kelvin actually might. He was halfway across now. The 9-year-old took off her jacket to go next. Kelvin's scarf snapped. He didn't react fast enough. His ankles unlatched and he fell, screaming. The girl on the other side reached out desperately, as if she could catch him from so far away. The crowd shrieked when Kelvin hit an old conveyor belt with a bone-crunching thud. His blood splattered across the metal, and his neck was bent at an unnatural angle. N hurriedly looked away, fighting her urge to be sick. One of the boys behind N vomited into his hands. The girl on the other side hugged the beam and stared down at Kelvin's body, moaning to herself. The crowds grew louder at the gruesome display, and the chaos below them became more and more violent. As the protesters brawled with the white boots, several other officials were making their way toward the stairs, toward them.
Time to move, the 9-year-old squeaked. My jacket isn't gonna break, so I'm going.
She made it across. By that time, the first girl had crawled off the beam to the window. Lola and N shared a look, an unspoken agreement to wait until the other children had crossed, despite the white boots charging up the stairs. Lola closed her eyes and pressed her face to the beam. Every few seconds, she lifted one hand to make sure that her top hat was still pinned to her hair. There was crying and pauses and cursing, but no more accidents. Everyone reached the other side.
I should go last, En said to Lola. I'll be the quickest. If I die, I will haunt you, and your children, and your children's children.